This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee at Starbucks with a double latte, skinny.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville. I'm Jason Stark. I write about baseball for The Athletic, and I am joined once again by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, distinguished former major leaguer, and the voice of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN Radio, Doug Glanville. And Doug, perhaps you've noticed, I'm sitting here in Starkville's Camp Nashville, otherwise known as the meetings. So I'm here. Right a few feet away, I see the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster. He's here. So, Doug, where the heck are you?
I am still probably about 1,000 miles away or so. But I'm actually covering winter meetings at ESPN. So we're doing every night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. We're going to cover the happenings of the day. A little slow the first day or so that we were covering this. We had Adam Ottavino of the New York Mets, or free agent, I guess, at this point. So that's what I'll be doing. So I'm here in Connecticut, just getting ready to head over to Bristol and talk some baseball after full days of trades and action and Ohtani signings.
All right. Well, I've observed this in the past when I'm here and you're not. Look, everybody who is anybody in baseball, they're right here. So I know I asked you this last year, but if you're not here, should people read anything into that?
Well, I don't think so. It could be very secretive. Like Ohtani doesn't want anyone to know where he's visiting. Yeah. So it's similar to that. For all you know, I could actually be in Nashville. You can't really tell. So, you just never know. I might turn around and appear in that river that goes through the hotel.
is that what it is? That's one of my theories, is that maybe you were traveling with Ohtani, helping him sort through his options. And so if that's true, Doug, you can tell us, where is Shohei going to sign? Come on, tell the world.
Yeah, I absolutely do. Teaneck, New Jersey, the new expansion of where I grew up.
Nobody thinks to look for him there, that's for sure.
See, so element of surprise. Never know.
Okay, I'm not going with Teaneck. I'm actually leaning now toward Toronto. Listen, if he actually visited Dunedin, Florida, the least Shohei-esque place that I could ever imagine him. I think that's a sign that he's serious about the Blue Jays. And I know they are extremely motivated to make him a Blue Jay. It would be an excellent place for him to be the biggest star in yet another country and still stay wrapped in his little comfort zone. And I think that's a huge fact. We talked about it before. Somebody said to me yesterday, if he wanted to be a Dodger, wouldn't he already be a Dodger? And I don't know the answer to that, but there might be some truth in it. I've had people who are close to him tell me he already knows where he wants to go, so why is he going through this whole dance? I would say we will know soon. I'm going to guess it's not going to be Teaneck. You want to change your answer?
Well, he surprised us with the Angels, so I think anything's possible. So I'm going to stay with Teaneck for a bit until further notice.
All right. Glanville's sticking with his answer. Wherever it is, though, there's a really good chance we might talk about it right here on the Athletic Baseball Show. Doug, you know what else we should talk about since we're in Nashville? How about baseball coming to Nashville? Major League Baseball. Because I think that's happening. So here's what we're going to do. Why don't we talk to a man who knows all about that? Hey, I'm so excited to welcome in this week's special guest here in Starkville, because he's always been one of my favorite people in baseball to talk to, going way back to when he was pitching against Philadelphia before he became a megastar. It's Dave Stewart. Stu, welcome to Starkville.
It's good to see you, man, and thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, we're really excited to have you here. And first reason you're here, for the last 3 years, you've been trying to get Major League Baseball to bring a team to Nashville. Why don't we start by having me ask you this? How did that come about?
You know, it's a crazy story. It started off actually with a friend from California that moved here initially to, you know, get back, well, to get out of California, which everybody's trying to do these days. But in leaving California, he had a daughter that was going to University of Kentucky. His wife had roots here in Nashville, and his son was out here. And so he decided to move family out here and come and just make life easier. The announcement from the commissioner came about expansion in, you know, Montreal and Charlotte, Nashville, Mexico City, Austin, Texas was a part of that. At that time, Las Vegas and Portland.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you start doing the thinking, and, you know, we're baseball people, you start doing the thinking, and the commissioner had already said it was going to be a two-team expansion, we started doing the thinking, and we said, well, Montreal, Charlotte, and Nashville are the Eastern teams. And then you start narrowing down the pros and cons of Nashville over the other two. And so I won't go over the cons of the other twos, but I will go over the pros of Nashville. As he was moving here, so were a lot of other people from the West Coast that were migrating to Nashville, one of the fastest growing states and cities in the country. There was already the Predators, the Titans, and the Nashville soccer team here, all being successful and successfully supported. Then you look at the tourism, which is year-round, all the time, nonstop.
Here, there's the music here.
Yeah, and then there's music. Then there's music, and there's food, the culture. And there's corporate businesses that are moving here left and right. And so when you take all of that and you put it together, we felt that this was the best place to plant our feet and give it a go. And, you know, that was 3-4 years ago. And now we're 4 years later. Nashville's been talked about prominently in terms of players wanting to be here and play here. Tourism is at its all-time high. There have been other non-baseball events that have been here that have been off the charts. It's just a great city, great people, and we feel that because there's strong sports support here anyway, baseball will be another piece of the puzzle, major sport that will come here and garner great support.
Yeah, well, you know this, but here at The Athletic, we did a survey of players this year. Where would you like to see baseball expand? And nearly 70% said Nashville, and nobody else was even close, any city. And so that's telling us something. I guess let me ask you the big question. Assuming baseball does expand at some point in the next few years, what is your level of certainty that Nashville will be one of the places that has a team?
Well, we can't be certain. That's going to come down to, obviously, the commissioner's decision. I think it would be difficult to ignore, you know, all that we know about Nashville already and what the city is about and all of the things that I just explained to you and demonstrated to you. I think it would be difficult to ignore that. But at the same time, I mean, there's more to it than just being the city. We have to know what the political support is for baseball here, which I think plays a major part of it. And, you know, once those things are solved, then we got to look at what's happening with Oakland, which has been ongoing. Even though we've got relocation, we need more surety of what's going to happen with their stadium situation. And then Tampa falls in that same thing. And, you know, Rob has been very clear that he does not plan to move baseball forward until those things are solid. So we'll see how it goes. But, you know, if I was a betting man, I wouldn't bet everything I have, but I bet a lot of what I have that this will be one of the expansion cities.
Yeah, I think that's a good bet. And since you brought up Oakland and you brought up Tampa Bay, I mean, both of them seem like they're headed toward new ballparks. Obviously, the A's are not going to be in Oakland if things go the way they appear. Mm-hmm. But you have a good read on that situation, both situations, I would imagine. You see both those things happening, both those parks getting built the way people are talking and acting?
You know, my interaction with the A's, which is not a lot, but enough, they feel confident that they're going to get their stadium situation taken care of. I don't have any communication with Tampa at all, but you know, they've got two potential sites to build a stadium and move that process forward. And so there is no reason to believe, especially with this being something that Major League Baseball strongly wants, that it won't happen. I think it's more of the timing of it. Obviously, the A's have taken 20 years. Yeah, in their stadium situation, and Tampa's been a while now, and so I would think that the preference is to have it sooner than later, and I don't know that there are any deadlines for that to happen, but it is a sooner than later situation for Major League Baseball.
Sooner always beats later.
Yes,
in life.
Of course.
All right, speaking of which, let's beam in Doug Glanville sooner than later. He's not sitting at the table here, but through the miracle of technology, we understand he can still ask questions. Is that true, Doug?
We can still do it. Stu, I've read a decent amount about the Nashville opportunity, and I know you've spoken a lot about how it's an opportunity to build bridges. You talk about the diversity of the leadership, the group that you're putting together or part of. Can you talk about the value of that, why that's important to really have this representative leadership going into this process?
Well, I mean, when you look at Major League Baseball, a 100-year-old sport, Artie Moreno is the lone minority in baseball ownership. And I mean, Major League Baseball has an initiative to grow the game. And in that initiative, it means having participation more from the Afro-American community. The numbers have dwindled down to 6.2 players in the game. When I was playing, it was 20%. Doug, you're much younger than me. I don't know what your percentages were, but it was 20% when I was in the game. And so there's an initiative with Major League Baseball to grow the game. When you look at some of the things that they're doing, even in their offices, you're seeing more people of color. You're seeing more women of different nationalities and colors. This year we had an HBCU All-Star game at the All-Star game in Seattle. Next year, we're going to honor Willie Mays and the Negro Leagues in Mobile, Alabama. And so they're having initiatives that point to timing for Major League Baseball to turn the next page, which is for an opportunity for a diverse ownership like mine. But even more importantly, when we say bridge the gap, you know, this will offer an opportunity for people in general to understand that this recipe, this blueprint works, not just in baseball, but in every business across the country and in every part of the country. And so, you know, I don't think that it's a dream. I think that this is something that can happen and will be successful. And I think that Major League Baseball, in its own way, they see that this to be an opportunity as well.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Stu, since we're at the winter meetings, you know, it's given me an opportunity to ask some people in baseball what they see. And, you know, there's been One thing that has come up that could be a potential obstacle to Nashville, and that is geographic territories, right? That the Braves might have an issue with it, that the Reds might somehow have an issue with it, that the Cardinals could have an issue with it. What's your level of concern that any of those could be a factor?
You know, I'll be honest, I try not to get involved in that. I think I'm going to leave that to be. I want to leave that to the commissioner. And we've had no real conversation about that. What I would point to is that, you know, the A's and San Francisco Giants existed 20 minutes away from each other. The Anaheim Angels and the Los Angeles Dodgers are 45 minutes away from each other. The Anaheim Angels and the San Diego Padres are less than 2 hours away from each other. And so I don't know that territory is that big of an issue. I do believe that it is difficult when you've held on to territory as those three franchises have for as long as they have. It's difficult to let it go. But I think that we can all coexist in the territories.
I don't think there's any doubt that you could coexist. you know how baseball moves. Mm-hmm. It can, like, we can be in favor of sooner, not later. Baseball sometimes moves a lot more slowly than we would like to see it move, but certainly hope it happens. And so one more question on this. Okay, let's assume everything falls into place. Oakland goes to Vegas. Tampa Bay gets the ballpark built. No objections from any of those markets we just talked about. You have your ownership, your ballpark plans, everything's lined up. Opening day, Nashville baseball, what year do you think that could happen?
You know, we know that we've got a CBA in 26, and my guess would be that this is not going to happen before that. You know, it's been whispered, and today I heard it was said in the commissioner's interview that he would plan to have shovels in the ground in 28. And so I'm going to take his word as the gospel that in 28, we'll have shovels in the ground. I was hoping that we'd be playing baseball by 28,
yeah.
At least minor league baseball by 28 and playing major league baseball in 29. But, you know, I'll take 28.
Yeah, could be worse. Doug, do you have one more on Nashville before we move on to Oakland?
Well, I know you talk about the Stars in terms of like name and how you're carrying that legacy, you know, with the Negro League. So I mean, why was that important to you?
The Negro League baseball, it's everything that I am. It's everything that you are. Without that league actually taking place, without it happening, my mentors when I first came into professional baseball were Roy Campanella and Don Newcomb. Those were the first faces I met when I was a Dodger. And having sit downs with them on a day-to-day basis and talking to them about the impact of Jackie Robinson on the sport and the impact on them being able to come in the game because of Jackie is important. And I think it's important to carry that legacy if we can do that. And so to be able to honor the Negro Leagues for the first time in the major leagues by bearing that name, I think is important and I think it has value.
All right, we've touched on Oakland a little bit so far, but you grew up in Oakland. Your greatest years as a baseball player were in Oakland. And it's just mind-blowing, I'm sure to both of us, that in a few years, there won't be any baseball in Oakland. Nobody could be closer to it than you. What do you think went wrong?
Well, you know, I've spent probably 18 years of my life after baseball as a negotiator for players. And I always look at the negotiation with players and the deals that I got done and the deals that I didn't get done. The deals I got done, I was willing to sit in the room for multiple hours late in the morning to pound a deal out because that's what I really wanted. But it was also displayed to me by the other side that that's what they really wanted. This Oakland A saga story has been going on for 20 years before the Fisher group took over this team.
That's true.
They were trying to find a new place to play, a better facility to play. And it just never happened. And so I personally, I hate that the A's are leaving. It's heartbreaking for me. I know the history and the background of the city and the athletes, the baseball athletes that have come out, of the Bay Area. And that's not to mention football. We've got those. We got a ton of basketball athletes. There's a rich, rich tradition of athletics in the Bay Area. But when the Raiders leave, when the Warriors return to San Francisco, and there's a behind the story, even with the Warriors on why it didn't work to stay in Oakland. I won't fault the city of Oakland, but they have blame. They have great blame. I won't place all the blame on the Oakland A's, but they do have great blame for this not happening. And it was just they couldn't come together in time to make this happen. I think that Oakland was late getting to the dance. And so the A's, they made a decision, and I think there was some pressure from Major League Baseball to get it done. They made a deal to get it done.
You know, but you just said this. Look, this Oakland had to happen. There's no excuse for baseball not to continue in Oakland. Whatever happened, it's the result of a lot of people on both sides who just missed the big picture. The big picture was baseball in Oakland. It was better for Major League Baseball. It was better for Oakland than this outcome. How could the fighting over each side's individual interests have never found a common ground on that key point?
I mean, that for me is the point I guess I initially started to make, that they just didn't want it bad enough, neither side.
Yes.
And the community suffers, and the fans suffer. I suffer from knowing what I know and being where I've been and the memories that I have. I suffer. But the two sides just didn't see the bigger picture strong enough to get it done.
Doug, you have some thoughts on this?
Well, you know, Stu, I'm curious, as a memento, any of your favorite memories of being an Oakland A or being part of that Oakland baseball community?
Well, my favorite memory of being a part of the Oakland A community is when I met Reggie Jackson as a young kid, going out to the ballpark and hiding out in the right field bleachers and collecting baseballs through BP and watching Reggie with his back to the infield, looking at me and my cousins gathering baseballs, and then eventually meeting him in the tunnel after the game and him calling us a bunch of smart asses and what are we doing in that tunnel? And you know, I said, hey, man, we were just trying to get an autograph. My cousin had caught a baseball from Rick Mundy, and he was trying to get the ball signed, and Rick Mundy came out of the tunnel and didn't sign the baseball and told us to go home because it was a school night. And Reggie was shortly behind him and the last player out of the clubhouse, by the way. And that's when he called us a bunch of smart asses, because when we were in the seats, he kept saying, old man Finley's going to kick us out of the stadium because we had snuck in. And we told him, well, old man Finley couldn't keep us from coming in the stadium, so how's he going to kick us out? And you know, for us, there was no security, so who was he fooling, right? So we were in the tunnel, and Reggie eventually asked us where we live, and we told him, and he did say it was a school night, and what are we doing so late? We told him, and he said, you know, well, how are you getting home? And we told him that our bikes were chained at this gas station, and that we were going to walk to the gas station and bicycle home. And he asked us if we wanted a ride, and I told him, man, you know, my parents, they told us never take rides from a stranger. So Reggie slow drove behind us. We were fast walking and actually a little bit of a trot to our bicycles, which were blocks away. And he slow rode and watched us get on our bicycles. And literally, we lived blocks from the Coliseum. We got to our house, and he rode behind us, and he drove off. And he literally made sure that we were safe.
Wow.
getting to my house, and then drove down our street a few times. And it took us a long time to warm up to take tickets from him. But we were always at the games. And
you didn't need no tickets.
Yeah, we were season ticket holders.
Minus the actual tickets, yeah.
And that is my fondest memory of Oakland and the Oakland A's. Was actually meeting Reggie, who I consider to be a big brother now. And, you know, I went on to become a professional, as we all know. But I had lost track of Reggie. And the first time I'd seen Reggie since I was drafted was when we played the Yankees in the 1981 World Series.
Wow.
And he had no idea who I was. And I was walking up, with my son at that time. And he was out taking batting practice. And, you know, if you know Reggie, he's serious about his extra work. And when he stepped out of that cage and I asked him to take a picture with my son, and he asked me what team I played for, and I said, I played for the Dodgers. Well, first he said, are you media? I said, no. Well, what are you doing here? I said, I play for the Dodgers. And he said, man, you see what I'm doing here? I'm getting my preparation in. You're hitting me, having me take pictures. You have me wasting my preparation. Man, what is wrong with you? And I said, Reggie, it's me. And he says, you who? I said, Dave Stewart. He said, little Stu? Yeah, man, it's me. And that broke the ice. And from 81, and we're now in 2023, we communicate with each other on a regular basis. And it was just great to reunite with him and now carry a childhood relationship into my adulthood.
Wow, what a tremendous story. I'd like to ask it this way, because I think about this all the time. Do you think back on what the ballpark was like and what your teams were like when you played in Oakland? It was something special.
We played in a great facility. We could, when it was the ballpark we played in, we could see the Oakland Hills and the skyline. And
before the footballization of it.
Before that happened. I mean, it was a great place to play baseball. A fair ballpark at night and a fair ballpark in the daytime, believe it or not. People talk about it now and how unfair it is with all foul territory. And I will give you some of that, but it was a great place to come and watch baseball. And, you know, when I think about our teams, and believe me, I don't take it for granted because I've got relationships today that I carry from that time. Ricky Henderson, I actually grew up with playing baseball with him in Oakland, but Carney Lansford and Dennis Eckersley. You know, Dave Henderson has passed, but it's a great relationship that I had in the game, carried after the game. Tony Phillips in the game and after the game. Bobby Welch, who has passed, was, I mean, the relationships, Dave Parker, Terry Steinbach. I mean, I could sit here and think about all the guys that I still communicate with from those teams and how great a period of time we were in. But, you know, what's crazy is when you're in it, you don't get a chance to really appreciate it and you know, after the game is done and you know, you're sitting on the couch and you're watching today's baseball and you get a chance to think back, you know, we really had an opportunity to do some great things. We missed an opportunity to win three, but we did win one. But those were some great teams.
Yeah. I mean, it's so sad that all we're going to have is the memories.
Yeah.
That's all anybody in Oakland's going to have unless they expand there. One more thing on this. Is baseball in Vegas going to work?
You know, I don't know. I think the A's are hoping that they can create the same magic that the Raiders did in Vegas. From what I understand, the Las Vegas Raiders were one of the highest revenue teams in NFL football.
It's a lot more games.
Yeah. And so I don't know if they can be successful or not, quite frankly. I don't know. I do know that if you're putting the same product on the field that they have the last 2 years, I think success is going to be difficult, but they promised that they're going to put money into the team. And so we'll see. I really don't know how that market's going to be for the A's.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch, man. I can't let you leave without asking you about starting pitching and the state of starting pitching, because when I look back on you in Oakland, you did something nobody's ever going to do it again. You had 41 complete games in 4 years. There's no active pitcher that even has 30. Justin Verlander is the leader, I think, with 28, 26, something like that. So How do you look at how starting pitchers are handled now?
I look at it seriously as the game has changed and the game has brought what it's brought to Major League Baseball. But I also know this, that Major League Baseball in the pitching department can't survive doing what it's doing at this time. It will kill relievers for sure. Starters are going to have to do more in the game. I was listening to Ted Simmons the other day on one of the networks. Yeah, he was talking about 4.9 innings is as much as starters go. That can't last in baseball. It can't last and the game be successful. Starting pitchers are going to have to get more to the 6 and 7 inning range. You're going to have to see more complete games because there are reasons to save your bullpen. There are reasons to do that. And those things have to happen for teams to be successful for a complete season. If you look at the teams in the World Series this year, the winning team was a team that that had better starting pitchers and starting pitchers that were capable of going a little bit longer in games. And I think that has to happen.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. You know, you came up with the Dodgers and you know, used to come to spring training and all the Dodger legends were roaming around Dodger Town. Mm-hmm. How many of them were starting pitchers? And think about what those guys represented in the game.
You know, I learned from Don Sutton. Al Downing was a part of my group at that time. I had an opportunity, as I told you, to talk to Don Newcomb. Don Drysdale used to come through. Sandy Koufax is one of the major factors in me being the type of pitcher that I became. It's important to have those guys talking in your ear. You know, the 421 seasons for me, consecutive seasons, you know, if I didn't idolize Bob Gibson, if Fergie Jenkins wasn't one of the guys that I looked at, I would never have aspired to win consecutive 20-game seasons. So those guys were important to me, and I think that, you know, it's just important to have those type of people to mentor you and place thoughts in your mind and give you dreams that are accomplished.
Yeah, we've got to incentivize pitchers and teams to get back to that. Mm-hmm. Doug, what are your thoughts on this one?
Well, I mean, I just love looking at the numbers, and you were top five in Cy Young pretty much, you know, consistently. The 20-game wins, the 250-plus innings. You know, you mentioned the mentors that kind of set that mentality. How did you sustain it? I mean, a lot of that happened when you turned 30. So this was like, you know, you were kind of like brewing like a fine wine. What turned that corner in those years?
You know, I always had aspirations in the minor leagues. I was a starter. And if you look at my minor league numbers, I put up some great numbers as far as innings pitched were concerned. You know, to make the major league team in that period of time, Dodgers starting pitching, as you know, it was some of the best in baseball. And so I had to break in as a reliever. And unfortunately, 6 years of my career, I spent as a spot starter and a reliever. Now, to turn the corner, one, I never, ever gave away the dream that I couldn't be a good starting pitcher at the major league level. And then to have the opportunity and to have the confidence shown to me by Tony La Russa is the difference in being what I was and becoming what I eventually became, which is, you know, one of the better starting pitchers in my period of time.
Well, Stu, we could talk to you all day, but Doug, you're not going to believe this, but Stu has people to meet with here that are way more important than you and me. I don't know how that's possible, but we're going to take his word for it that he does. Listen, man, it is awesome to have you stop by Starkville live and in person and to catch up. Tremendous.
Thank you so much.
And all the best with baseball in Nashville. Hope we're watching games here in what year is that again?
28.
There we go. 2028.
Sliding, catching, and going into the dugout.
So the bad news is no trivia this week. Just a little too hard for us to pull off here at the winter meetings. But ready for the good news? Doug Glanville has not gone anywhere. And you know what that means? It means it's time for us to venture down to the dugout. And that's where the great American storyteller, Doug Glanville, hangs out this time of year and spins so many great stories of his life and times. And in theory, these are about baseball mostly, but sometimes they'll veer in other directions. So I can't wait to see where this week's tale takes us, because our topic for the week is what else? Hall and Oates. And by that, I mean Mel Hall and Johnny Oates. I mean Doug's all-time favorite singers, band, duo, Hall and Oates. If you listen to this show, it's come up that these are Doug's all-time favorites. But the reason to bring it up now, of course, is Hall and Oates are having a little dust-up, by which I mean, Doug, they're suing each other. Actually, it's just Hall who is suing Oates. But nevertheless, that's caused some issues. So, Doug, what better time for you to tell us how you knew these two guys personally, right? And if I remember, this has something to do with baseball.
It does, and it did. Well, it's look, this is a long history, and I go back to Kiss on My List. You have to go back to the early 80s when I first saw them, and I didn't have cable at the time, so I didn't have MTV. So I'd catch them on like Friday Night Videos, and you know, that's when they were starting to come into their number one hits. And so I pretty much was hooked early on. And I think the dynamic was interesting because, you know, culturally, you listen to them and, you know, we didn't have videos as much until those 80s. So it was like, I heard gospel, I heard church, I heard things that were familiar to me and particularly my mom's side of the family. And then when I first saw them and I realized like, oh, this is not a black band. It was a little stunning because, you know, they had the sounds of something that I associated with church. And, you know, Daryl Hall's, you know, father was, I think, a Methodist pastor and reverend. And, you know, they had that history. Now, for me, once I sort of dove into exploring their music and the hits started rolling, you know, Private Eyes and Maneater and all these groups, these songs, when I was in sixth grade, my teacher, Andy Six, was married to John Styx. And John Styx was the editor of then a very popular magazine called Guitar Magazine for the practicing musician. And real bona fide musicians would read this, and they'd also contribute, you know, songs, music, editorials. And one of his key editors was, or writers, was T-Bone Wook, Tom T-Bone Wook, a Philadelphia area guy, bass player. They always say he was the ampersand of Hall and Oates. And, so he was great, and he passed away, you know, less than 10 years ago, but he was, you know, really a soul part of this group. And so, you know, they started to, you know, I started talking about the music, and my sixth grade teacher, we graduate elementary school, we go on to, you know, seventh grade middle school, and she invites us back, or some of the class, back to her house for dinner. So we go there, and we're all sitting around. And it's like, okay, talking. And at some point, music comes up, and I tell him Hall & Oates. And he's like, oh, really? You know, I know their band certainly well. And he's like, I could introduce you to them. Now, imagine I'm like 13 or 14. This is exciting. And he says, no, well, you know, I'm going to make you work for it. So I remember he took out his magazine and opened it up. And there was a, you know, they used to have like these kind of centerfold pictures. And I think it was of the group Heart, you know, Nancy Wilson and I forgot the other Wilson. And so he signs on this thing. This is, now keep in mind, this is like 1983 or four. And he says, hey, all right, I'll make a bet with you. If you make it to the major leagues, I will introduce you to Daryl Hall and John Oates. That was the deal. So, you know, I'm 13, 14. I'm like, well, nothing to lose here. So I have this this picture centerfold. And now fast forward, you know, I get called up in 1996. And Hall and Oates weren't really touring at the time, or they were kind of adrift. And they reconvened over an album, I think it was in 97, called Marigold Sky. And at the time, they started the tour again. And sure enough, I was traded to the Phillies. Philadelphia, that's the basket of where they grew up. And they're in Radio City Music Hall. So I'm making the call, collecting on my – and now we're almost approaching 15 years removed of this bet. And so I bring all these Phillies jerseys, and I sign them. And I'm backstage, and I get these passes from John Styx. And I'm backstage about to meet Daryl Hall and John Oates. And sure enough, I meet him backstage. Tommy Mottola was their first manager. So, you know, I see him backstage. I'm like, that was surreal. And I start talking. And John was just sort of, you know, hanging out, talking to me. And all of a sudden, I hear the drums going for the first song. And I'm just like, don't you have to go out there? He's like, no, man, I got like 3 minutes, so we can keep talking. Yeah, so we ended up talking, you know, for a long time. I became very cool, their tour manager, who was a huge Cal Ripken fan for the Orioles. And I remember I got Ripken to sign spikes for me later in his career, and I gave one of the spikes to his tour manager. And so it started to, like, blossom. I started going to shows backstage and became really good friends with John. And at one point, I think it was around my birthday, is when Schilling got traded to the Diamondbacks. He came back, and we had a day game in Philly. And so they had John Oates come to the game, talk during in between innings, and then come out and change the bases. You know, they used to change the bases every 3 or 4 innings. So we built this nice friendship. And to this day, you know, I've done stuff for his book tour. I've seen them, you know, tens of times. My kids know their music. And baseball has kind of been in the center of it because, you know, multiple times, John Oates' son's first game was a Phillies game that I invited them to. And baseball swirled around. So I made this connection that was, you know, different because I was, you know, a fan as a kid, made this connection through being in sort of the spotlight as an athlete and then seeing how much we really had in common in their music and their style. And so, you know, to the end, regardless of what happens, I understand business and things go awry at different times, but they've done music for, you know, 40 plus 50 years. You're talking about longevity, it's really over 50 years. And so I know for me, their music has been a mainstay and something that's been central to my life. So when I, you know, was in the Phillies coming out to my walk-up song, we had no can do. I can't go for that. So it's a Hall & Oates, baseball. It's all part of my 80s love, and it sustains.
But let me get this straight. The only reason you made the big leagues is so you could meet Hall & Oates?
I mean, the motivation was there, man. I was like, wait a minute, I can meet these guys. So, and my wife always points out that in my book, Hall & Oates, they're mentioned like 6 or 7 times in my wife's visit.
Only 6 or 7? What's wrong? Okay, so Doug, we've got a serious issue here. Say it isn't so. You know, have you digested the fact that these guys are going to sue each other, and because of that, you're never going to see them play, sing, make music again?
I don't know how it's going to end up because, you know, these groups go through stuff all the time. And then, you know, there might be a reunion. There might not be. The thing is, like, what I appreciated about them was that if you look at their albums, their covers, it always says Daryl Hall and John Oates. It never says Hall & Oates. And that was part of a testament to, like, they wanted the individuality. And maybe Daryl Hall, you know, sort of like a front man later in the 80s. But they always had this sort of separate, you know, world. And John Oates has done tremendous solo work and single work. So you can still see them. And they, as of now, they were touring together as well. I don't know if that will continue. But I've seen them, you know, John Oates. I saw him this summer, just one town over. Got to catch John there and go to the sound check and all these things. So, you know, so I think I got a lot of funny emails and texts when the news broke about this lawsuit.
I contribute
and people. Yeah, people were highly concerned for me. And so I remember Marcus Hayes, the Philly writer, he wrote, he's like, well, you know, who's going to get custody of you? So I was like, you know,
who does get custody?
Nope, never. Yeah, you can't pick sides in these guys. You can't pick sides. And, their music is always, they have such a catalog. I'm not worried about their legacy. I went to their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction in whatever year that was, 17 or something. So they've done it, and I think they'll continue to have this amazing catalog, and they still put out some good work. So hopefully, you know, they get back together. I remember years ago I pitched John Oates on, there's an album, H2O, which is actually on my watch here, if you can see it. Okay, so how do I do that? Oh, it's upside down. Okay. So anyway, it's them staring at each other, right? This is where Maneater and, you know, all these songs come out, One-on-One. So I said, hey, John, you could do this, like, take a picture now and call the album Time, because now you got two guys 40 years later staring at each other. And then you could write about, like, the evolution of your lives. So that was my pitch, you know. So I feel like they've done tremendous work. And the fact that they were huge in the 80s, yet they had started their albums in early 70s. They had like 10 albums before they really, you know, had the, you know, Private Eyes and all those songs. So They have a lot of musical chops, and I have a lot of respect for what they've done, especially how much they've appealed across different, diverse elements of our world. They're very universal in their style. So, so hopefully I'll write something about it. I'm, thinking about it. But for now, baseball was my way in, and baseball will remain my love and my love for their music.
So I hope everybody noticed how delicately Doug danced through this whole thing. He wants no parts of taking sides here. Watch that. They'll chew you up, man. Listen, I'm counting on you to restore peace on Earth, or at least peace on Hall and Oates Earth. We need this to happen, okay? If Doug Glanville can't do it, I'm just worried about the future of humanity. And on that note, I should also mention that's going to do it for this week's show. We'll be bringing you podcast magic just like this all off season long on the Athletic Baseball Show, which is available in its entirety, absolutely free, everywhere you get your podcasts. And if you would like to help your friends or loved ones read any of the amazing coverage of Shohei Ohtani, the winter meetings, this fascinating baseball offseason now taking place in The Athletic, we can tell you how to do that. If you go to theathletic.com/baseball show and you're buying a gift for a new subscriber, you can buy one of those gifts for just $19.99 for the next 12 months, or two for $39.99. Please don't do that math, but it works out fine. So there's always that. But also remember, you too can be part of this podcast. Every show, except for this one, we pick the most fun listener trivia question of the week. And then that lucky listener gets to join us right here and prove once again, there is no baseball trivia question we can't get wrong. So how could you join us? You can always email us at starkville@theathletic.com. Or to be honest, what most people do is they hit us up with their questions on the site that the ancient settlers used to refer to as Twitter. Doug, I believe you were once an ancient settler. So if someone wanted to join you in your settlement camp on Twitter or X or wherever it may be, where could they find the Doug Glanville encampment?
Well, back then we talk about the settlement. I was known as Doug Glanville. Now I'm Doug Glanville, formerly known as Doug Glanville on the new system X. So you'll still use the at symbol, so that's fine. And just spell my name out, Doug Glanville, DougGlanville, and then I'll find you.
Yeah, one of the great traditions that they actually called Doug Glanville, Doug Glanville, for as far back as any of us can remember. Yeah. As for me, you don't have to call me Jason Stark. You can find me at Jason S-T, J-A-Y-S-O-N-S-T. Also, please remember to hashtag those questions, Starkville Q-S. So, Doug, thanks for playing. Thanks to Dave Stewart for visiting us in person here in Nashville. Thanks to the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, for producing us and putting up with us. And thanks to you all for listening. Doug and I will see you soon on
Starkville.